Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is there any requirement that they obligate the borrower to pay collateral, not in cash, but in whatever he may...
If a lender insists that he wants collateral, but then in that particular case, the borrower can be required, you know.
But even...
Yeah. After all, the lender is still doing it, he's not getting any interest for it, but at least he wants to be sure that it's going to be collectible, you see. All right, so the other one, all right, getting back to the Rashi over here. All right, so Eino Yochel, right, he's not allowed to bug him, even if it's not the seventh year, right? So, Kevan de lo kavinin bay lo yigos, lo kavinin bay shamot, the so possibly de lo yigos. So, even though Rashi says that, you know, it says that you're not allowed to bug him, and nevertheless, you might say, you know, that, you know, it shouldn't cancel out, but finally, you know, he wants to get his money back, he's going to bug him for that. So, v'hochim ishtama be'ekro lo yigos bizmano esvayehu. You're not allowed to bug your, you know, the person who borrowed the money from you, at the time, you know, when it has to be collected, because Shemitah has been already proclaimed, you know, even prior to that. So that therefore, as I mentioned, it created chaos, particularly as it approached the seventh year. I mean, you know, if a person, let's say, in the first year of Shemitah has said, look, can you give me a loan? And you know, you lend because you figure, look, certainly within the next 6 years he's going to repay me, right? If not 30 days, so maybe it'll be 3 months or whatever it may be, and so and so, if you understand. But, you know, Shemitah is way off yet. But, let's say 30 days prior to Shemitah, and he comes and says, lend me some money, and you know that the expiration of the day when he's supposed to pay you, it's already Shemitah, and he's not obligated anymore. Yeah. You're not going to be so ready, you know, to lend money, you see. So this created a problem. So what happened in the days of Hillel? Remember, this is yet before the beginning of the Goyish era, right? Before the Common era. So Hillel came up with the Takana. Says Moshe Sholevez, he says, who Prusbol? This is the Prusbol, says Rashi. Shehiskin Hillel, which Hillel... you know, enacted. Okay, that's the right word. Okay. Prusbol is probably based on two Greek words. Okay? Pros in Greek means in the presence of, and bule in Greek means those who are the people in authority, like the judges or the authorities in general. Okay? So, in other words, you go to the presence of the authorities and you give them this, all right? As you can see, this is one of the words, you know, that was created at that time and, you know, based upon one of the common languages that was spoken there as well. Besides Hebrew, besides Aramaic, they also spoke Greek. And a little Latin as well, yeah. Depending upon, you know, which circles.
Was that when
in
Israel were going through Hellenization, or was that before
this
that?
This is even later than that.
Later than that.
Yeah, because... the Hellenistic period, this would be the period prior to the Maccabean revolt, okay?
Yeah, right.
Which, if you remember, would be 168 to 165 prior to the Common Era,
right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Hillel lived roughly about the last years prior to the Common Era, okay? Maybe extending into the first years of the Common Era, okay? So this is when he lived. So, but you know, naturally, during all this time, Greek culture had been established. In spite of the Maccabean revolt, Greek culture was definitely a part of the Near East at that particular point. And of course, the Romans, because of their military supremacy, they were governing the roost.
Didn't they translate the Bible into Greek too?
Sure. But that happened again. That happened, you know, after the Hellenistic, after the Maccabean revolt, but roughly maybe about 100 years prior to the Common Era, okay? When they translated. Yeah. Okay. So, getting back over here. All right. So, Rashi explains, though, this is the enactment that healed it. Shekosav bo, and what is written in the shtar. Right? So he says, written in the Shtar is as follows: Mosreni lochem, I hand over to you Ploni Floni Hadayonim, right? A and B, the judges Hadayonim, Shebemokom Ploni, in this and this place, the Dayonim of this and this local court, right? Shekol Chov Sheyesh Li, that whatever debt is owing unto me, She'egvenu Kozman She'erze, that I can collect it anytime that I feel like it. Now, what I mean, I can collect it? In other words, I can come to the Beis Din and say, I want my money right now. And the Beis Din has the right to go and to summon the borrower and say, you got to pay up, my friend. Otherwise, we can put, all kinds of assessments and fines and so on.
This is before the 10 years or after the 10 years?
This has nothing to do with the 10 years. In other words,
anytime during the 10
anytime, years. Anytime at all, right. Because the person who is handing the Prusbol does it just prior to the 7th year, and the implication is that any time that he wants to get his money back, he can do it. Now, during the Shemitah year, maybe he wouldn't do it because, it goes counter to it. But let's say in the 8th year, he could go to the Beis Din and say, I want my money. Sorry. My throat is still bothering me. Okay. Ditnan, getting back to the text of the Gemara, says, after all, we learned in the Mishnah, it's the Mishnah Shri's, it says, Hamal be'el ha-mashkein, ha-mesh shol le-bezdin, ein mashmin. Says, if a person lends money on collateral, or if, the creditor hands over his documents to be collected by the Beis Din, then in that case, Shemitah is not, doesn't count, doesn't work. Ikudi Amrei, now there's another version as to what the discussion was. There are those who say that this is what the discussion was. Omer Rabbi Yehuda, Omer Shmuel, that Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, he said, Hamal Beis Chaver Liyasa Shonim, Ein Shvi'is Mishamato. He says that what Shmuel said was actually that if you lend the other guy, money to be repaid in 10 years, then in that case, Shvius will not, cancel it out, right? The Aval Gav, the Osin de De Lo Yigas, Hashta, Mihulo Kevin and Be Lo Yigas. And even though eventually he may have to try to bug the guy in order to get him, but nevertheless, right now, he is not violating the law of Shvius, which says you're not allowed to bug. Okay? So, as we can see, there is already a difference of opinion between them, because according to the first version, right, that Shavuos is expected to cancel it out, even though the loan was for 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, the only way out was to go and, either give your notes to the Beis Din, or to take collateral, for the loan, right? That's version number one. Version number two says, Shmuel has said that if you lend for 10 years, then this law is not applicable. So, of course, this raises, more problems. Omer Rav Kana, so Rav Kana said, Afana nome tonino, he says, look, we also learned in the Mishnah, what does it say? It says, Omdin kam odem rotsa detain, you elements be yodo. Bain the tame khan, be adlamid yom, bain the tame khan, be adesashonim, right? Doesn't our Mishnah say, how much would a person be willing to give in order to have 1,000 zuz in his hand, whether to repay it within 30 days or whether to repay it in 10 years? The yamid shviyas mishamato. And likewise, if you say that, the 7th year is going to cancel out the debt, then kuhunami boy shinumile. Then in that case, these edim zomim have to pay the full amount to the guy, because this is what the creditor would be out, or rather the borrower would be out. I mean, you wanted to force him to pay the 1,000, right? On the basis of your testimony. That, they came and they said, within 30 days he has to pay, right? That was the agreement. You want him to pay that full amount. Well, in that case, this is what you, as Adam Zimmerman, are going to be assessed. So, Omar Rava, Rava said, Hochaba Mayaskinan, what are we dealing with over here? He says, what is the case in point? B'malvel ha-mashkon, b'moysa shtol v'vesdin. So, again, you know, they come up with the same solution, that either you're lending the money with collateral, or that you give over your documents to the Bezdin and let them collect. Ditnan, as we learned in the Mishnah, Malvel ha-mashkon, b'moysa shtol v'vesdin, they must beat them, right? That doesn't cancel it out. Okay. So the Omer Rav Yehuda Omer Shmuel, and Rav Yehuda said again, the name of Shmuel says, so Omer Lachaveiro, what if a person says to the another one, you know, he says to the other guy, he says, look, Al Menosh Lo Tishbateni Shviz, I'm willing to lend you money provided that you know, you won't cancel out. Maybe in Tishmateni should really be read probably as Tishamteni over here, that you're not going to cancel out your obligation to me in the seventh year. Then in that case, nevertheless, what happens? Shviz Mishametas. The Shviz is still going to cancel out that debt. Why? Because Lema, are we to say, Kosava Shmuel, that Shmuel is the opinion that Masne Al Masha Kosava Torahu, that he is trying to make a condition contrary to what is written in the Torah. The Chol Hamasne Al Masha Kosava Torah Tanoi Botel. And we have a general rule, we had this in Kedushin, believe it or not, many, many years ago, that if a person wants to make a condition which is contrary to an explicit law in the Torah, then his condition is invalid, no effect, whatever. Okay. So in other words, you say, I'm willing to lend you money provided that you will not cancel out the debt that you owe to me doing Shviz, that you can't do. Can't do that, because Shviz is the law of the Torah and it's going to cancel it out. So, needless to say, if that's the case, how can we get around this problem? Okay? And also, is it analogous, is it exactly the same as the first condition that we said, where either he lends on the basis of collateral that the borrower has to give him, or on the basis of the fact that the lender goes to the Bezdin and says, Bezdin, you collect to me. Okay? Is this the same? No. Why is it not the same? Because this is a private arrangement. And it cannot make a private arrangement which runs counter to what the Torah has to say. Okay? So that's the difference between them. The Hoy Itmar, and now they raise this question, Taka, and they say, look, didn't we learn, happens to be a Gemara in Bava Metzia, for example, that Omer Lachaveiro, if a person says to another guy, he says, Al Menos, She'ein Lecho Alai Oino, alright, so this goes into the business of what is Oino. Ono in general is translated sort of like fraud, okay? Or overreaching. Seeing that translation too. It's not a very good one, because when you say overreaching, what's overreaching? I don't know. That's why I like the word fraud, right, is a little bit better. Okay. But there's a law in the Torah, if you remember, where it says, "Velo sonu ish es ochir." You're not allowed to defraud
your brother.
Your brother, right. So, how do the sages apply it to Gemara Bav Metzia? So, they apply it in various ways. Obviously, one is that you're not allowed to give him, for example, false counsel. If you know that you're giving him false advice and you're doing it, then of course that's a no, you're cheating him, okay? That's called Inas Deborim, okay? And then, of course, you have Inas Ksafim. In other words, overreaching when it comes to monetary matters. In general, the Chachomim say that a person is entitled to a decent profit. After all, he has his expenses and everything else. But what is considered a decent profit? So they say Shesus. What does Shesus mean? It means one-sixth.
One-sixth? 16% roughly.
Yeah, right. Roughly, right. Okay, that they consider, you know, being legitimate. Okay? Now, If a person charges more than that amount, then they feel that it's already in the area of onor. In other words, as I said, overreaching, he's guilty of fraud according to the chafal. Okay? But it goes even more beyond. I mean, it could be, you know, that for example, you agree on a certain day to buy this and this, and then, you know, the price either goes up or goes down. So it all depends how much does it go up or how much does it go down. If it goes up, let's say more than this 1/6, or it goes down less than the 1/6, then in that particular case, we could say that if both parties are willing, then it's an agreement and they're not going to kick back. But if you know, the parties are not willing, they say, look, you promised me this and this amount, right? And here you're trying to cheat me by charging me this and this, right? Or whatever it may be. So
you're not supposed to. Making a profit is like charging interest.
No, not so. A person has to live.
That's for making a
person
living.
Has to make a living. He's not doing
it in the business of lending money?
No, I'm not talking about lending money. I'm talking about in the market. You're selling a commodity in the market.
You change the
Yeah, right. And it's so north, okay? Oh, no. So, no, I can't give you all regalachas, you know, all the rules that pertain to it. Obviously, it's a complicated business. But I'm giving you the general highlight, you know, that an agreement, if it involves what would be considered, let's say, a legitimate spread, either up or down, within the range, then both parties may be satisfied. But if the parties are not satisfied, and particularly if it goes either too high or too low, then either party must retract, and you make good the difference, or you cancel the sale, or whatever it may be. Okay? Because we want to make sure that people are not going to take advantage. It's a moral responsibility. That, you know, if you're selling a commodity, that you have a moral relationship between the buyer and the seller.
In other words, you're talking about the collateral being sold.
Whatever, I'm not talking about collateral. I mean, let's say that you're in the fruit business, okay?
Yeah, well, what does it got to do with the subject at hand?
Okay, now we'll see what is the relationship over here, okay? All right. He quotes over here the Mishnah, which says, what? Ha'omer l'chaveiro. If a person says to the other guy, Al menos she'ein l'cho alayi noa, you agree that you're not going to come to me with a taina that, you know, I have defrauded you, and therefore, in other words, you're willing to abide by whatever decision we make right now, and that's it. You're not going to try to cancel out the agreement, right? So, Rav Omer, Rav says what? Yesh alavai noa. Nevertheless, he says, the law of Onoah still applies, which means what? Which means that, you know, if he overcharged or something like that, then in that particular case, he has to make good to the person. Even though...
good the difference?
Right, yeah, it has to make good the difference, of course. It has to make good the difference. Even though he said to him, I'm selling this to you, and you must agree that you're not going. In other words, you're not allowed to do what? Masnel divrei Torah. You're not allowed to make a condition which is going to be a violation of what the Torah itself specifies. All right? So this is Rob's opinion. Now along comes Shmuel. Shmuel Omer, he says, Ein lo alav eino. Says he doesn't have the ability right now to retract and claim, you know, that he was defrauded. So that if the guy says, promise, you know, I'm selling you this item, right? And you promise me that you're not going to invoke the claim of Onoah against me, then in that case, the guy cannot come back and say that, you know, afterwards and say, look, I charge you with having violated my rights, you know, by overcharging me, okay? So we see that there is a difference over here between Rav's opinion concerning Onoah and Shmuel's, right? Now, what did Shmuel just before say? Shmuel said before, right, that if the guy borrows for 10 years, then in that case what? Ein mashmitin, right? Then in that case, the law of Shemitah does not apply.
Right.
So this would seem to be exactly parallel then, right? He says, not only if you have a long-term loan, the law of Shemitah is not going to apply. By the way, he didn't say anything, you know, he didn't say, like, for example, you have to go over to the Besdin, give your notes into the Besdin. He simply made a generalization, right? That the law of Shemitah is not going to apply. And that would be consistent with the same thing over here that he says. If you say in your agreement of sale
that
you're not going to claim a Noah, then in that case you cannot claim a Noah. This is what Shmuel is saying, even though Rav says no.
Yes.
Okay.
The Torah takes precedence.
Yeah, incidentally, in this case, Rav is the guy, according to whom the halacha follows.
Mm-hmm.
Halacha follows Rav in this case, okay? Yeah. It's always, you know, with Rav and Shmuel, the two of them are always arguing with each other. Sometimes the halacha will follow Rav, and sometimes it will follow Shmuel, okay?
Because that was a practical solution to it.
The practical solution would be along the lines of what Shmuel said, but nevertheless, Rav says nothing doing. He says you cannot you cannot defraud the other person. If it's a question of fraud that's involved, then you have to make good. But either you cancel the sale, or you make good the difference, you know, between the real sale price, what it should be, and you know what you overcharged.
But he's drawing a parallel to the loan.
Correct. So Shmuel is drawing a parallel to the loan, right? Because he says, you know, Shmuel Omer ain lo alo banor, right? That you cannot come and claim you defrauded me. Okay? So it says, so Igmar alo, so then we learn in connection with this, Omer Rav Onon, that Rav Onon said, Lididi mifesh olei minei de Shmuel, and to me, they explained this statement of Shmuel as follows. Shmuel said, if the person says that you do not, you know, when I sell this to you, you cannot come and claim a Noah to me, then in that case, you cannot come and claim a Noah, right? But what if the language was as follows? Almenos she'ein bo a Noah, which means I sell this to you on condition that there is no onoah involved in this, in other words, there's no question of fraud involved in it, then hare yesh bo onoah, then in that case Shmuel says of course the law of onoah applies, because why? You sold it to me on the commitment that there was no fraud, that there was 100% kosher in accordance with all the laws, you know, prophet concerning, you know, prophet laws and so on and so forth, right? But it's not so. It wasn't so. So in that case, the law applies. So Ochinami. So likewise, in our case again about Shemitah, right? He says, Almenos Chelo Tishamtene Bishviz. That's why I said I changed around a little bit of the voweling over here. If, says Shmuel, you come to me and you say that, you know, you are not going to cancel out on me in Shviz, this is your commitment to me that you're not going to cancel out your debt to me because of Shviz, then in that case, Ein Shviz Mishamato, according to Shmuel, right? Then in that case, Shviz is not going to cancel out that debt. Because, as we said before, anyway, it was a long-term loan, so, you know, if it's a long-term loan, how could you get around this? You see? So, in other words, this is what he's saying. What is the wording? If the wording is, you agree beforehand that you're not going to cancel out on me during Shviz, in that case, Shviz will not. But, Almenos Shalotish Pateni Shviz, I'm lending you this money provided that Shviz doesn't come and cancel out my debt. Shviz Bishamato. Shviz certainly is going to cancel out the debt.
You've got to be crazy to agree to that.
Right. Well, as I say, people, you know, when it comes to borrowing and lending, and you're doing it without any interest, so in that particular case, you have to rely upon goodwill.
Exactly.
No question. Goodwill on the borrower's part, goodwill on the creditor's part, there's no question about it. Now, at this point, we have a general statement that I alluded to earlier this evening. Tana. We learned the Baraisa, which says as follows. It says, Hamalbez Chavero Stam, if a person lends money to another guy without any other specification, then in that particular case, Einu Rashai Letovo Pochos Melamidyon. He's not allowed to come and demand payment from him
within
less than 30 days. Right, 30 days have to pass before he can do it. Okay? So, Sova Rabba Barachona Kamed Rav. So, Rabba Barachona was trying to figure this out in the presence of Rab. And he said, Lemeimar, does this mean then that Hani Mila Bimila Bishtar? We're talking here about a loan which has a written document to testing, you know, to what the conditions on the loan are. The Lo Ovad Inesh, the Torah, the Chosav Shtar, but Tzir Mitlasin Yemen, because nobody who is going to lend money for less than 30 days is going to go to the trouble, he says, of having a written document and so on and so forth. Right. Aval, Milval Peh, if it is an oral loan, then lo. Then, in other words, what? It could be repaid even what? Within 30 days. Right. So, Omale Rav. So Rav said to him, Ochi Amar Chabibi, says, this is what my uncle said. Chabibi, and usually when we use it in modern Hebrew today, it means my pal, my friend, and so on and so forth. And the word Chabib, which means beloved. But
as Rashi points out, uncle,
right, Rashi points out the fact that the word Dodi also, you know, either meant, you know, literally my uncle, or it can mean, you know, somebody was close to me, my close friend, or something like that. Okay, like when we say Lachod Dodi Likras Kala, we're not saying, "Come on, Uncle, let's go and meet the Shabbos queen."
Okay,
but over here, he was referring to what his uncle had said. And what did he say? What did his uncle say? I lost the place for a second. So he said, yeah, right. Habibi, this is what my uncle said, he says. Echod hamalde bishtar, v'yechod hamalde alpeh. Or maybe we can say, echod hamilde bishtar, v'yechod hamilde alpeh. Let's take the second reading better, because milde means loan in general, okay? So it makes no difference whether it is a loan
written document attesting to it, or whether it is a loan.
Which is only oral. It makes no difference. What? That you cannot collect in less than
30 days.
This is the general rule. Okay? Tanya Nami Hochi, and likewise we learned another Baraisa which confirms this. Hamalves Chavero Stam, that if a person lends money to the other person without any further conditions, he doesn't, you know, write the document with the different conditions, then Einu Rashai Letovot Pochos B'Shloshim Yom. He's not allowed to demand payment in less than 30 days. And it's Echod Hamelde Bishtar, V'Echod Hamelde Alpeh. And it makes no difference. It could be either a documented loan or it could be an oral loan. Omalei Shmuel Rav Masna, and Shmuel said Rav Masna, he says, Lo Seisev Akarech, he says, don't sit down on your feet, or on your knees, or something like that. Karech means, we know the word, you know, Korea, to bend the knee. Okay. Right, exactly. So he says, don't sit down on your knees, literally, okay? Admin Farashtos Lo, Lo Shmato. Until you have explained to me this particular dialogue, okay? This particular inyan, as we would say. In other words, what we're dealing with. It says, Menoah Milsa, the Omer Rabbonan. How do we derive the idea, you know, that the rabbi said, Amalves Chavero Stam, that if a person lends money, you know, without specifying any more than that, you know, so Eina Rasha the Tov Pox Belabid Yom, he's not allowed to demand payment in less than 30 days, and Echad Hamilva Bishtav, Echad Hamilva Alpeh, and it makes no difference whether it is by document or whether it is orally. So Amalei, he said to him, there is a pasuk. What is the pasuk? He says, Dichsiv, pasuk says, Korvo Shnas HaSheva Shnas HaShmita. The seventh year is drawing near, the year of Shmita. Okay? That's what the pasuk says. So he says, Mashba Shenema, certainly, inasmuch as it says, Korvo Shnas HaSheva, the seventh year is drawing near, Eini Yodei Shishnas Shmita. Don't I know that this is the year of Shemitah? Mm-hmm. So why does it have to say Shlash Shemitah? So it says Elomar Talmud Lomar. But what is the Torah trying to teach us? It's trying to teach us as follows: Shnas HaShemitah. Why does it say Shnas HaShemitah? It says Lomar Lecho, in order to tell you that what Yesh Shemitah Acheres, there is another type of Shemitah, Shehi Kazu, which is also in the nature of a Shemitah, in other words, in the nature of like a cancellation, the Ezu, and what is it? He says, Zu Hamalves Chaveru Stam, that it is a person who lends money to the other one without specifying, you know, what the conditions for payment will be. She'enu Rasha Litovo, the Pochos Mishloshim Yom, right? Because, and he's not allowed to demand payment from him less than 30 days have passed. In other words, this is so to speak that just as Shemitah, the regular Shemitah, cancels out, and you're not allowed to oppress the other guy by demanding payment, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the cancellation of the debt, or as we said, at any time you're not allowed to bug him, right. Not allowed to send the collectors after him.
Before,
okay, right? So the same thing with a loan, you can't not demand payment in less than 30 days. The Yom Amar, because we have a statement which says, Shloshim Yom Bashono, Choshev Shono, 30 days in a year is already considered like a year. So the point is, then what? 30 days in a year, and I'll come back to that in 1 second before we dive in Mincha. The 30 days already counts as if he had lent it to him for an entire year. Okay? As if he had the means, you know, to go and use the money for whatever, so now time for payment has come back. Okay. Now, what is this business of Shloshim Yom Kishono? This is based upon a different law in the Torah. It's based upon the year of Orla, upon the idea of Orla. You know what Orla is? Orla means that if you plant a tree, okay, yeah, then during the first 3 years, yeah, it's written that the fruits are arelim, literally, you know, that they're uncircumcised, to translate it exactly word for word, but it means it's out of bounds, right? And lo yeyochelu, you're not allowed to eat them. Okay, so the question is, do you have to keep a genealogical chart, you know, as to when actually you planted this tree? In other words, if you planted it on, let's say, if you planted it January the 1st, okay? So, you have to wait till January 1st of the next year, that counts 1 year, and then January 1st of the second year, and then January 1st of the third year? So the answer is no. You don't have to do that, because of this basis that if it's 30 days, then it's going to count already as a year. In other words, let's say 30 days prior to Tishrei, okay? Let's say the 29th of Av or something like that, all right? Let's say on the 29th of Av you planted it. And that's 30 days, you know, prior to Rosh Hashanah. So in that case, when Rosh Hashanah comes, so that already counts as though it was the first year. And then from Rosh Hashanah on, it's going to count as the second year, right? And then the following year, if you go 30 days into the third year, so that already would count as the third year. So in other words, it makes it a lot easier, as you realize.
It would be 25 months then.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, I'm going at the minimum, but you know, not necessarily doing it. You know, you wait until the 29th of Elul in order to plan. Obviously, it's going to be more than that in the usual case. Okay. So this is one of the things. Remember, I said you got to look on the cans of packages from Eretz Yisrael. You see that they'll tell you it's free from Tevel, which is means that Trumas and Masras were given from it. It's Noki Me Orlo, in other words, the fruit, the vegetables, whatever you have in there, you know, they have gone at least three years without. Okay, actually, it should be a fourth year as well, but three years is the minimum. Okay, the reason why I say a fourth year is because in the days of the Beis Hamikdash, the fruits of the fourth year they would bring to Yerushalayim and eat it over there. Since we can't do it anymore, so we observe an extra year. All right. So in other words, we observe 4 years. But as you can see, since part of a year counts as like part, so there's a little bit of leeway that's involved with that. And then the other thing is Daki Mishriyas, you know, that this was not grown during the seventh year. Right. Okay. And at this, we will call a halt this evening. Well, it's time for us to Daf Minchas. Yes, we're down on the bottom of Daf Gimel on the base, right towards the bottom, right there.
Okay.
Okay, Rabbi Hanani ben Akashon, what's up?
You're on.
All right.
It's July 12th, 1995, and we're on
Daf. And we are right on Daf Gimel,
Ahmed Bey.
Ahmed Bey is towards the bottom. All right. Yes. I just want to call to mind again something that we learned last week, because it's connected, you know, to what we'll be learning tonight. Okay? We learned last week, if you remember, that we were talking about loans, okay? And one of the basic problems is that if a person, for example, takes out a loan from somebody else for 10 years, so the question is about the business with Shemitah. Mm-hmm. Does it cancel it out or does it not cancel it out? And about that, we saw different opinions. One of them, of course, being the opinion of Shmuel, who said that it all depends on the wording taken out at the time of the loan. If a person, for example, says, you know, I'm lending you this money on condition that Shemitah will not cancel out this debt, then in that particular case
it
has no effect, because Shemitah definitely will cancel it out, since you cannot be what? You cannot be Masna al Divrei Torah. In other words, you cannot you cannot make a condition which is contrary to something that the Torah itself specifies. This is what we mean by master, make a condition, okay? So, how about any other possibility according to Shmuel? So, according to Shmuel, he says, yes, you could make the following. If you make a statement to the effect that, you know, Shadot Tishamteni Shviz, in other words, that you're not going to cancel out on me in the seventh year, even though the seventh year comes, but you're not going to cancel out on me, then in that particular case, the Shviyas will not cancel out the debt. Or we learned alternatives. And what was the alternative that we learned? The alternative that we learned is that if you give a loan, so in this case, you could either do it in one of two ways. One would be Malval Mashkan, right? That you loan the money and you have collateral for it, in which case the fact is, you know, that in case the person doesn't pay up within the specified amount of time, so then the creditor has the right to keep the collateral and to make use of it, right? And that would not be dependent upon Shavias. That's one possibility. The other one
is Shavias would not interfere with that.
That's right, right. And the other one is that you be Mesesh Toros of the Vestin. In other words, you can hand over the note upon which, you know, the note of the loan, which obviously is a legal document in this particular case, and you can hand it over to the Beis Din, and in that case it becomes the responsibility of the Beis Din to collect for you. It's no longer your own personal responsibility, and so that's another way to get around, you know, this problem. And of course, why was it necessary in the first place? So this is, we explained, why did Hillel, for example, find it necessary to make this prosbol, wherein a man goes to the Beis Din and he says, here is a note and I appoint you at this particular time, it's now yours, you collect it for me, okay? because he saw that as the seventh year was approaching, people did not want to lend out money.
But isn't that circumventing the Torah?
Yes, yes, but I guess the answer is, then we come back to the other problem. The problem is that there are legal ways to circumvent sometimes. Not saying that there's a general rule for this, but at times it may be necessary for whatever circumstances there are, so there's a legal way to do it. Right? As in the case of these three different ideas that we mentioned, namely to hand over the shtar, or to make a loan on collateral, or that you make an agreement saying that you personally are not going to cancel out on me. Okay?
That's also circumventing.
Sure, it's circumventing. But nevertheless, he already has something that whereby he binds the debtor. Now, the debtor, of course, if he wants not to be guilty either of shviyas, so then what can he do? So he can pay his debt, for example, in less amount of time, right, to pay it up sooner, then in that case the problem would not exist. Okay. But at any rate, this all started with a statement which was made by Omar Rav Yehuda. In other words, Rav Yehuda said it in the name of Rav, and then it was challenged by Rav Kada. So now, in the next group of statements, we're going to have similar statements being made, wherein Rav Yehuda quotes Rav as being the author of a statement, or maybe he'll say that Shmuel is the author of a statement. At any rate, the point is that it's going to be challenged by Rav Kana, and then we try to straighten out the contradiction between the two if we possibly can. Okay?
Good question.
Sure.
We're talking about present collateral, not future collateral.
Right. Definitely. In other words, the creditor has that collateral.
At the point of the loan.
Right. Because then, you see, he can collect. But if he doesn't have the collateral, then in that particular case, it's like anything else that has to deal with monetary affairs. Monetary affairs, there's a basic rule that says, Hamotzi mechaveiro, all of haraya. If you want to get something out of the other guy, you have to bring your proofs that it's coming to you. Naturally, it means that the bezdin has to go and try to enforce the, you know, whatever ruling it's going to make in order to try to collect. Because otherwise, you're of Taurus, you can't. Or, you know, as they used to say, that the, what is it, possession is 9/10 of the law. So whoever has the thing, so he has the upper hand, there's no question about it. If he wants to deny it, then of course has to go to a bezdin. And they have to adjudicate between them. But nevertheless, this is a general principle in monetary matters.
Because they can say that the collateral is not worth the value, and at the
that's
time
already a different story.
Yeah. It can go down or even can increase.
This I agree with you. It is possible, just as we saw in the discussion the other week about the ksuba of the woman, that if it's nifsei melug, right, she comes into this marriage and she brings a certain amount of money with her. Now, who can play around with it? The answer is the husband can. He can either use the money in order to increase the wealth, or if he's a gambler and you know things go the other way, so that he can fritter it away. She, therefore, upon his death, or she tries to collect the ksuba, let's say if she's divorced, he says, look, this is all that it says over there, and take it or leave it. You took it with the stipulation that it was nifsei melug, then in that particular case, if I don't have it, it's your tough luck because of the fact that I used it and, you know, it was an investment that turned sour. On the other hand, we said nifsei tzon barzel, there we said it's a different type. That if she comes in with that type, then in that particular case, he can only enjoy, let's say, profits on it, what they call peiros, literally fruits. He can enjoy that, but it must be returned in the full amount, whatever it was that was given, that she brought in into the match.
He can use the interest, he can't use the principal.
That's correct, yeah. So, as we see, you know, the same thing, getting back to your business. I mean, the collateral is true. It may go up, it may go down a day. But the point is, he still has something tangible. This is the difference.
I'm sure that the fluctuation of collateral value would be taken into consideration when the loan is paid. So
it could very well be, yeah. since we're not there as witnesses for the loan, we don't know exactly what was the language of the loan. But nevertheless, if he has collateral, then he has something that he can do. On the other hand, what if the
collateral increases in value to the point where it's much more than the loan was worth?
Well, then obviously the guy who borrowed the money, he's going to try to get it because it's to his advantage to do it. So it's better off to pay off the loan and then we'll be able to get his collateral back. Sure, that would be to his advantage. Besides which, of course, I don't have to say, there's a moral obligation.
I would think that he would take the money that he loaned him and then, without any interest, and whatever profits were involved, that he would give it back to the person whose collateral was originally.
The only thing is, profits belong not to the person who lent the money. Profits belong to
the person. The person who borrowed the money.
Correct. I mean, we're making a distinction right now between the collateral, which may or may not increase in value, as compared to what does he have to pay back? What he has to pay back is the money that he borrowed, right? But he's not to pay back more, he's not to pay back less. Certainly he's not to pay back more because that would be interest.
That's right.
And, an interest is prohibited. That's all there is to it. I mean, just as the creditor has a moral obligation to lend because he has to help out a fellow Jew, right? Mm-hmm. So likewise, the debtor also has a moral. Also, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Rav, time and again I pointed out that very often in order to be able to remember all this material, which remember was all orally transmitted, you had to have a tremendous memory, and you also had to have people, who had this terrific ability to memorize text after text. And then, when it came time for discussion, they tried to gather at times different statements with the same author. So that this is why we'll often have a string. And this is what we have over here. Because the next inyan has nothing to do with either Eden Zomimim or the Tzvias. It's thrown in. All right. But, you see, this is the beauty of Marcus, in my opinion, that we deal with a variety of topics which... even though they may not be 100% germane to the immediate problem, but nevertheless they introduce some interesting material, right? And it gives us a much broader view of the world of Talmud, so to speak, and the world of Halacha. Okay. All right. Question over here is as follows. Omer Rav Yehuda, Omer Rav, says, HaBaseach Beis HaTzavar B'Shabbos Chayav Chatos. Okay. So the statement that he makes is that if a person, for example, had a piece of material which he wants to use, like, let's say, as a poncho or something like that, okay. The reason I say like a poncho is simply because in those days, what Yehuda wanted to do, they'd take a garment and they'd make a hole in it, for your neck and your head, to go through, and then the rest of it would hang down around your body. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was, like what we do with a knob of compass, for example, It's the same idea, okay? So, he has this piece of material that he wants to make into a garment, but what does it need? It needs...
An opening
in the neck, right. The Beis HaTzavar, literally the house where the neck fits in, okay? Place where the neck has to go. So what if he opens up that on Shabbos? Then in that case, Rabbi Yehuda says the name of Rabbi says that it's Chayav Chatos. In other words, he is guilty of transgressing the law of the Torah, and since he did it, the Shogeg, as we would say, he did it, not realizing the fact that this was prohibited on Shabbos. He was ignorant of the fact, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He was ignorant of it. So because he did it in ignorance, so therefore, what was the atonement? The atonement is to bring, the chatos, the sin offering. So this is what Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rabbi. Good evening, David Meyer. Welcome home. So, Matzke for Rav Kama. So again, Rav Kama objects to it. And he asks the following. He says, he says, tell me please, what difference is this from the fact that on Shabbos we do have a law which permits us to take off the top of a barrel. All right, time to take a look at the Rashi, of course. Okay, Rashi is, you see Ksubas on the side over there in the margin. You see, Bamatsiyan and Olive, Ksubas and Olive, and so on, okay? And then it says, Bechi, Ma, Ben, Zen, and Gubba, Chavos. This is this question, right?
Right.
So, Daminin, as we say, Beperek Chavish and Ishbaron, is a chapter in Masechah Shabbos that begins with the words, you know, a barrel that got broken. That what? Dimatis Rosha Bishabbos Messiah. You are permitted to cut off the head of the barrel on Shabbos with a sword, liftoach esechovis, in order to open up the barrel, so that you could use the contents inside. So now the question is, how come that, you know, in one case we say you're not allowed to open up a hole in the garment on Shabbos because in that particular case it is prohibited, and here you can make a hole.
Yeah, you can cut off the top of a barrel.
Right, and in the barrel you can make a hole in order to get to the contents. Okay?
You don't mean cut off the whole top just to make a hole in the top.
Well, the implication is you do the whole thing, but we'll see in a second is the reason that's behind it. Right.
Well, is the stuff in the barrel going to be used for Shabbos?
Yes, that's the idea. Naturally, not to do it, let's say, for Sunday. Okay? It has to be used, exactly. Of course, this leads us in general to another problem that we have on Shabbos. And about this, I don't have to tell you. There are Mekilin, you know, people who are, they're not so strict about this particular aspect of Shabbos. And of course, there are also Machmirim. There are people who will not accept, you know, the Heter to do it. I'm talking specifically about, for example, taking off a bottle cap on Shabbos. Okay? The old fashioned bottle caps, they were no problems. Why weren't they?
They weren't sealed.
Huh?
They weren't sealed.
That's right. They weren't sealed that night. Exactly. No, you could, you know, pry it up or something like that. You know, that's where the bottle opened, something like that. So they didn't really present the problem. They were exactly like, you know, what the Gemara is suggesting. Okay? Just pop off the top. Okay?
Right.
The new ones with the screwing, there are those who hold that they're not allowed to do it on Shabbos. So that if there are machbirim among the group, you know, they're not going to open it up. Naturally, what do they have to do? They have to open it up. Erev Shabbos, unscrew the top, and then put it back on again, so that in this case, what are they simply doing? They're only removing that. Yes?
What av malacha does that transgress, the action of screwing or removing action?
That's a good question. Which is the av malacha that's involved over here? I can't even give you a specific answer for that.
Well, some say that
the
you
business
can,
were
you can
about
it if there's no writing on it. If there's writing on it,
right. Correct. See, that's even more difficult, you know, in the case of a package which is sealed, particularly the way they do it today. That, you know, how can you do it? But if you take the makel view, then in that case you can, let's say, take a knife and cut through, which would be the same as what we're saying over here. Okay. And of course, others would say, look, it's your tough luck, don't use it, and so on Shabbos. Make sure that you do all your preparations before Shabbos. But as you can see, there is this problem that's involved, okay? There are, different problems. Namely, that on Shabbos, you're allowed to do certain things for food that you're going to eat immediately.
Right.
But you can't do it on a long-term basis.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
That is an Isser of Shabbos.
Right.
That's...
For example, this is a general principle. Let's say, for example, to make a salad on Shabbos. If you're going to be eating the salad very shortly, so you're allowed to cut it up, okay. But to cut up a salad, let's say, Shabbos morning, because you're going to eat it Saturday night, maybe even later in the afternoon, that's considered not right.
Yeah, borer is...
borer is a different thing. Borer means that you choose something and you don't choose something else. So under certain circumstances, borer is prohibited. It's also prohibited malacha. And there are lots of malachas that are prohibited. Yes?
I don't want to get off this.
Yeah.
Too much off the subject.
Yeah,
but
right.
I remember in Eider, it caught my attention.
Yeah.
For example, if you had pecans and almonds, all right?
Yeah, all right.
So You're allowed to shell them, of course, and put them in a bowl, mix them up, put them in a bowl if you're going to eat it immediately.
Right.
However, if you're going to take, let's say, like, for example, make like a decorative plate, either with these nuts or with like an olive or like a cucumber and olive, you weren't allowed to do that if it was going to be eaten at a later point in time, much later
point.
Well,
it's the same as the celery.
Yeah, that's
what I said over here. Right, exactly.
So you're arranging stomach. It doesn't make any difference. It's a question of when you're going to eat it.
Right, exactly. If it's meant for, immediate or almost immediate use, you can do it on Shabbos. Otherwise, it's not considered in the spirit of Shabbos to do it. Okay.
Right, even though make the same selection.
Right. What was the issue, however, that's involved in the first thing that he brought, namely about making a hole in the garment so that you could wear it on Shabbos, okay? Which, as we said before, is prohibited, okay? But nevertheless, it's only considered, that he has transgressed and he would have to atone with the chatos and so on and so forth. But what is actually the basis of the prohibition? This is the question. So the basis of the prohibition here is a different thing. There is a law concerning what we call Gemar Melacha. Gemar Melacha means that you complete the labor of something on Shabbos. Okay? Specifically, what does it mean? Well, the first example that they give is called Makabek Patish.
Right.
Literally, that you strike with a hammer. Okay? In other words, if you have something that requires just one more bang from the hammer, then if you put in that last bang with the hammer on Shabbos, you are completing the labor, and that is a transgression of Shabbos. It's one of the things you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, okay? Now, with this thing too, the garment is not complete yet. What is going to make the garment complete?
Putting the hole in it.
So that it could be, then worn. Well, when you're doing that, then this is another example you see of Gemar Melacha, and which is analogous, as I say, to the Makabe Patish. So that this is the prohibition that's involved over there. All right. So now, however, they want to analyze this. Okay. Yes.
You take a garbage bag for a kid and make a hole in the top, and you make holes.
Yeah.
Sleeve hole.
Yeah.
Sleeve.
Yeah.
This means you could make a sleeve hole on Shabbos as long as you don't make the other sleeve and the neck.
No. It would apply to the same thing.
Oh, this so is no the importation here is that the garment is already made though before Shabbos. But he only put the hole in it in Shabbos.
Yeah, this is something that's puzzling me because you can't start a job on Shabbos. You can't finish a job.
Right.
If you only say that, then you can continue a job.
Technically, you can't make a generalization.
Well,
you have to go always to specific cases. You see, David.
Yeah. So
you have to go on the basis of the specific case.
So I gave you a specific case.
Yeah.
You've got to make three holes, one for the neck, one for each sleeve.
No, so they're all prohibited.
Say if you've made one hole before Shabbos for the sleeve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you make one more hole, you haven't completed the garment because you need
this
the
is correct.
Hole.
Yeah.
That means technically you can make the second hole then on Shabbos.
No.
Why not?
Because of the fact that the minute that you're making another hole, you're already transgressing Shabbos.
So
we're talking about, and what is the punishment to this guy?
But
punishment is that he has to bring a chatas because he did it unwittingly. Now, if you're telling me deliberately to do it, so that's already been mazed. Mazed is already worse. Yes.
Just picking a piece of thread.
Yeah.
And you absentmindedly pick out the basting from something.
Yeah, by the way, not allowed to pull threads on Shabbos either.
I know. Absentmindedly doing it.
You're not allowed to do that,
I think his question is at what time is the Gemirah.
The Gemar Melacha. Gemar
Melacha,
right. Right. Right.
That, I think, is his question.
Basically, there's no question. What is the right way to observe Shabbos? The answer is to make all your preparations before Shabbos. And that's the way you do it. That's all. Okay. This is the right way to do things.
Yeah.
Not to look for a heter to do it
on
Shabbos. Okay.
I'm puzzled about the concept that you can begin work and can't finish work.
Yeah.
And it's puzzling, always puzzled me about working, but not
okay.
Not
the point is, you see, that what we're talking about is the fact, that this really is like compounding the transgression when you complete it. But nobody says you're allowed to begin, you know, something which is a transgression simply because you didn't finish it. Right, exactly. You shouldn't. So Shabbos is not an easy concept. It's a wonderful thing, but we have to remember, right, that there are things, you know, that you have to prepare before Shabbos. Mi shalei torach b'erev Shabbos, mi yochal b'Shabbos. Right, if you don't prepare erev Shabbos, then what are you going to have to eat on Shabbos itself? So you have to begin your preparations beforehand, and the same thing applies to the various malachos that have to be done. Some people, for example, will not open a can on Shabbos, even though if you apply the business, you know, that you're, the megufa, as they say over here, you know, that it would be permissible, you know, the megufa's chobis, right? It's like just taking off the top of the
barrel.
The barrel would be analogous. And yet, if you're a machmir, you're not going to do that. You're going to do all these things, open up cans, Erev Shabbos, open up soda bottles, Erev Shabbos, open up packages, Erev Shabbos, which is the right way to do it. So on Shabbos you can sit back and rejoice and,
and drink
and this is the way it is. Well, look, the way these things that screw on screw off again, they do a pretty good job. They really do.
Well, you can get it, you can really split hairs, because then
you
open a refrigerator, you start the motor, you don't start the motor. You turn on the water, do you start a pump somewhere where the water is being pumped up to your house?
As far as the water is concerned, everybody is doing it. But with the refrigerator, that's already a different story. You're right. I mean, there are those who,
I mean, you can carry it to
the light is no question. There should not be a light on that Shabbos. I mean, because if you open the door and the light goes on, it's the same as though you're kindling a light on Shabbos itself. Okay? But talking about as follows. Okay. When you open the door, eventually it's going to heat up a little bit on the interior. Naturally, if it heats up a little bit on the interior, eventually it's going to cause the motor to resume running again until it cools it off. All right. So the question is whether this is a direct connection or whether it's only a secondary action. In other words, you didn't, by opening up the refrigerator, cause the motor to run, but it only happened incidentally after you did it. Okay? So, if you're a machmir, you don't.
You don't open the refrigerator.
You open it. Well, you do. You know when? When you hear the motor running, so then you can do it, you know, and...
you may have to wait a few hours.
As I say, that's being, you know, a machmir.
Yeah, the but they would leave the refrigerator door open slightly on Shabbos, and they'd wait for when they went to their closet. But they would basically leave the door.
Well, that I don't know that people necessarily have to do. Maybe that was their interpretation of it. Okay.
Yeah.
This I don't know. Or maybe somebody in, you know, maybe somebody in 770 told them that this was the right procedure. Okay. Rav Dick Oliver Shalom, for example, had a timer installed in his refrigerator, so that every 15 minutes the timer would have the engine the motor running, and during that time they would wait for the motor to run before they opened it and closed it. Okay, so but the truth this was Harab Dick Oliver Shalom. The reason I mention him is because I knew him personally, and he's very close also to Anne's brother-in-law and sister and so on. And in fact, now the wedding that we went to in New York was a wedding between his grandson and our nephew's daughter and so on. He was one of the great lights in the Borough Park. Before that he was in the Bronx, and he was considered, you know, a great posek. People would come to him with shivas. So this was his opinion. But others who take a more lenient view, you know, they accept the other one, that when you're opening it up, your intention is not to make the engine run. Understand? So that the engine is running, shalobi miskavi. In other words, it's not intentional. Okay? And
you can carry that
an Isser on Shabbos, right. An Isser on Shabbos should be something which represents an intentional violation. Okay? So if it was unintentional, then it's not as serious, you know, as if it was intentional.
So, when the time you open a door, you walk out, the heat goes on and so forth. You
right.
Know, there are lots of things that
you right, exactly.
Do all kinds of stuff.
You have air conditioning in the house if you want to say that.
Right.
Yes, that particular case, opening doors, opening windows, you know, they might all. But it's so remote, you see. I mean, this is not your kavana. You're not being miskaveh in order to cause the air conditioning to go on or off or anything like that.
Not to go
the refrigerator.
Off on its pantry,
right.
What is this business about, folding a talus?
Folding a talus, this is something else. There is a prohibition against mekapel. But how to interpret this kapel means folding, because in the Mishkan, you know, the laws of prohibited labors on Shabbos ultimately derived from things that were necessary in the Mishkan itself.
Right.
Okay, this is the basic principle.
Of course.
Okay? So, obviously, material had to be folded in the Mishkan. So that, therefore, the kapil is a prohibition. However, how do you define the kapil? So there are those who say that the kapil only applies if you take something which was never folded, you fold it, okay? But if something has been folded and you unfold it and then you fold it again, you're not violating that issur, okay? So that this is the reasoning behind it. And again, as you see, I mean, you have machmirim and you have makilim. Yes.
I'm not asking you as a rabbi, but does that mean some people would say it would be inappropriate to fold a napkin to serve, to make it the table more pleasant?
No, nobody would take that too seriously.
Okay.
Yeah, nobody would take it seriously. Particularly, I mean, you fold a napkin in order, because in a minute you're going to unfold it and use it. So, nishkapela. Folding the talus, you may not wear it for a day or two or for a week or something like that. But, look, I'm not telling you what to do, whether to fold or not to fold, okay? That I have to leave up to your conscience. But the reasoning behind it, this I can tell you, okay? This is the reasoning. But remember that if you do fold the talus, you have plenty of support on great authority. So, okay.
Halacha is not a matter of conscience. Halacha
right.
is a halacha. That's
right.
All it's either,
right.
either is or isn't.
Yeah.
That's why we have...
Well, but this is why we have it. We
that's
have
why
to
now
interpret
you have,
it.
Now you have kosher and glatt kosher and glatt glatt kosher.
Right,
that's
right.
why you have that.
Yeah,
well,
but
I think also that those perhaps who frame the halacha don't want to make a thicket out of it, a brambles that leads to, like, for example, when you mentioned the idea, if someone has to worry that every time they walk out of the house or into the house, they will be doing an Avera, in other words, that they there's going to be a total Av Malacha that will spring into being, that would create...
I mean, that's
a,
if you have air conditioning,
difficult
that's a problem.
Situation.
If you don't have air conditioning, it's not a problem.
Well, but he mentions heat in the winter. You must have heat in the winter. Air conditioning arguably could be a luxury. So it's hard to find
the
support that you
All right, it's an idea. I'll accept that. That might possibly, theoretically, be a problem. But we have another statement. Statement is that we in these climates, we're all like choylem in the presence of cold. You know, we're all inclined to be sick in the presence of cold. So in that particular case, this is the reasoning why, you know, we can have heated chambers. If necessary, you can hire a goy, you know, naturally you have to make your arrangements before Shabbos, you know, that he should come and, you know...
Light the fire.
Light the fire, well, that not so much, but, you know, whatever it may be, you know, but permit it to keep, you know, the heat going in the house or something like that, okay? This may be done. All right. So, at any rate, as we can see, you know, there are many, many pros and cons. Anyway, they come back, I mean, to discuss what is the difference, and it's what they say. The chima bein zeh, the megufas chavis, right?
Excuse me, I've got the classic, either the most stupid or the most brilliant question. Which is, if you're not supposed to begin something, how can you have sexual intercourse if you may conceive a child, which is the idea?
Wait a while, I'll go...
Be guarded in your speech.
Okay. Yeah, this is not the beginning of an action which might result in something. It's true, may not. I understand. But as a matter of fact, in the Gemara, the question only refers to the first time that you have intercourse. As to whether you can have it initially on Friday night or not, okay? And the reason there is because, after all, you're creating a wound, okay? Creating a wound. I mean, if the wife is a virgin, as we hope she is, you know, so you might possibly, you know, be creating a wound. So that in itself, you're not allowed to inflict a wound on Shabbos. You're not allowed to. Okay? Just as there's a prohibition, you know, you're not allowed to have bloodletting on Shabbos or something like that. Okay? So there are those who say that takazoi, that if it's the first time, you're not supposed to do it because of this possibility. But on the other hand, the majority opinion is, what? You're engaged in the mitzvah. It's a great mitzvah to be able to procreate and to have children. This is the, you know, one of the basic purposes of getting married. So in that particular case, even Friday night is the first time it's permissible.
Don't they say usually Friday night is the mitzvah?
Yeah, well, afterwards,
afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, afterwards, no question.
That's why the women go to mikvah.
What about his question? I'm curious.
What?
That comes to challenge the idea that it's a mitzvah, but actually could be an avirah.
Yeah. You have to remember that sometimes you may have opposing mitzvahs, okay? So in that case, you have to determine, you know, you ask shilas and things like that, you know, as to what overrides what. We're going to have an example of a plus and a minus in a few moments if I get beyond this line over here.
So David is implying that you're doing an avera.
He can say it's an avera. I'm not saying it's an avera. I'm telling you it's a mitzvah. He says any result in gemirat malacha.
Gemar malacha.
Yeah, that's
now we don't worry about that. That's a remote circumstance. That's what I'm telling you. Do we know it's a miracle when conception takes place? We don't know when it's going to happen.
We've got to assume that that's why we're having sex, isn't it?
That's one of the basic reasons why. Yeah. It's not the only reason why.
Yeah, there are other reasons.
I mean, there's the idea of love between man and wife. Yes. Isn't that important?
Yes. You're saying things like kiss.
After all, what do we say in the marriage blessings, right?
Yeah, and you're supposed to.
Sameach, samach reim ha'ovim, right? We cause them to rejoice because sameach ha'yitzircha began Adam and Kedem, even as. You know, you enable them to rejoice in Gan Eden. You know, namely referring, you know, to Adam and Eve. They rejoiced also because the Rebbeinu Shalalem created them, and you know, and they had a good time until they sinned.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Nope. Right. I think we did.
Yeah. All right. So, if I'm permitted to continue, so they want to know. Rav Kana objects, and he says, "Rochima ben Zel and Gufas Kovis." Right? So tell me, he says, you know, to Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav, right? Rav Yehuda was speaking. So he says, "Okay, tell me, Rav Yehuda." He says, "What difference is this between, you know, the garment in which you say you're not allowed to make a hole because it's Gemar Malach, as we said, as compared to, you know, chopping off the top of the barrel, right? Opening up a, you know, something which is..." So he says, look, he says, Omalei. So he answered him, he said to him, Zer chibur, Zer ner chibur. He says, in the case of the garment, well, the whole thing is connected. You make a hole, you're actually being destructive in this particular case, and we're not allowed to destroy if it's going to result in building up, in other words, of improving, which of course is what happens. Okay? So we're not allowed to do it. Whereas in the case of the barrel, to begin with, it wasn't. All right, let's take a look at Rashi for a moment. Why wasn't it?
Because it's broken.
Yeah. So he says, you see, when it says chima ben zel and gubas ha'chobis, he says, I'm fair chobis, right? They're permitted to do it. So he says, this, right, the base hatzavor, when we're talking about, you know, making the hole in the garments for the neck can go through, he says, hoya chibor. This was all connected to begin with. So, hilkoch, hosa, the minute that he opened, he made a opening. So, this is tikkun chodeshu. You're making a new improvement in the garment itself. And that, as we said, is prohibited on Shabbos. Avol ha-megufa, but as far as the stopper of the cask of the barrel, he says, afal pishi tucho al piachovitz. Even though, let's say they plaster it down. Tiach means plaster, right? Even though it's plastered down. In other words, they would put, in those days, they would put a cover on and then plaster it in order to sort of seal it. But nevertheless, he says, tucho al piachovitz betit, right, with plaster. So Ein Zeh Chibur, he says, this is not a real Chibur. It's not a real connected thing. V'Havelo Kifesucho V'Yomeres. And the barrel is as if it was opened already, and the remains open, even if you put a cover on, and that you're allowed to remove. All right, so now we come to another inyan that he says. Yes?
So if paper towels, sort of paper, if it's perforated,
yes.
Does that mean you are allowed to tear?
You shouldn't. You shouldn't. I don't have to tell you. Things that maybe halachically you could find a heter for it, okay, but it doesn't mean that to begin with you should do it when you know that there's something that's wrong about it. I mean, what do I do Erev Shabbos?
You tear the paper.
I tear, right. I know we're going to need paper towels, so I tear several sheets and we have it ready. I mean, this is what I do, so that there shouldn't be a question of that.
Yeah, good, right.
And as far as toilet paper is concerned, that's another problem. So you buy a box of tissues and you use that. That's all.
This is not related to the text.
Yeah.
I want to cover something out with tin foil.
Yeah.
I have to have the tin.
You don't mean tin foil. You mean aluminum foil. Yeah.
Aluminum foil.
All right.
I have to have the aluminum foil cut before.
It should be cut before Shabbos.
It should be. But
yeah. Once you have it cut before Shabbos, you could use it to cover. Of course,
if
no question.
It's not cut before Shabbos, so can you?
No.
No.
Unless you're going to put the whole roll on top of it.
Oh.
With the box.
No, but if you have it cut, don't you? You have to cover something with it. You have to bend it. You have to.
Yeah, but that's not an issue. That's not really. That's garnished, okay?
Okay. All right.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, if you have it prepared, then you can use it. That's all. You have in mind already before Shabbos that you're going to use it specifically for this purpose. That brings in another business, you see. You see, every sentence that you're uttering brings in a new point of Jewish law, right? You've heard the expression mukhtse.
Mukhtse, yes.
Yeah, what does mukhtse mean?
Mukhtse?
Mukhtse is, my understanding is that, in a sense, an impure object that you shouldn't move on Shabbat.
Well, not impure, but something which is not a Shabbos-tik thing, right?
Right.
Or once it has been used on Shabbos for its original purpose, you may not be able to move or to make use of or something like that. This is the basic idea of Mukhtar.
For example, if you use it on Shabbos, you can't use it during the week.
No. That has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, for example, I mean, you're not allowed to move the leichter, let's say, on Shabbos. I mean,
right.
Okay, why? I mean, after all, they perform their function on Shabbos, right? Friday night that they were burning and everything else they're doing. But Shabbos already, they serve no purpose. As long as there are no candles lit in there, of course, you're not allowed to make a fire and do it. So in that case, we say that it's smoked. In other words, you don't touch it. Okay.
Okay.
I don't touch. I mean, we don't touch. We don't touch coins, wallet, and things like that on Shabbos. Why? Smoked. Even if it's within the house, and you're not taking it out. I'm not talking about having to carry. You understand? Right. Which would certainly be an issue. Well, let's say even within the house, you're not going to go for coins or for your wallet in order to get something out of it.
Right.
Because this is something that is relegated for use during the week, but it's not in the spirit of Shabbos in order to do it. So it's mukhtar in Shabbos. Okay?
What if there's something that you use during the week that you also use on Shabbos?
Yeah, that's all right.
So okay.
And it's not mukhtar. But the idea of mukhtar is that you have to have in mind before Shabbos that you're going to use something that you're permitted to use on Shabbos. That's the difference, okay?
If something is in your way, aren't you allowed to remove it?
It depends which way. Depends how you remove it. You couldn't remove it in an ordinary way. You might do it in some extraordinary way, okay?
And I've been to people's houses on Shabbos where they'll put the wife of jewelry or something on the tray that the candles are on. So
yeah.
Then she'll somehow she's now allowed to move the tree because she's not moving the candle, she's moving the jewelry.
Okay, of course, so that's the same category as, for example, moving a table on Shabbos. Okay? Shabbos has the lichter on it, the candles are burning. Can you move it somehow or other? So the answer is, if your mind, what you have in mind, is not to move the candles, but to move, let's say, the bread or something to make it more accessible, you know, the challah, whatever it may be, so in that case, you can move the table then. Okay? So that's the same analogy. Okay?
Okay, you may proceed.
Well, thank you. But you see, yes.
To plaster, is that lahatia?
What?
To plaster.
So yeah, lahatia, right. Or latuach, also, latuach.
Latuach?
Latuach, right. This is the way that the Gemara would say, toch, right, you know, the present tense or past tense and so on.
Okay.
Yeah, toch petit and so on, right. And plastering in modern Hebrew, I mean, Yossi was talking to Bela on the phone, discussing the new apartment and all the problems that they're having with the builder. And, you know, they're talking about ticha.
Ticha, sure.
Ticha, you know, plastering and so on, yeah. Because the guy went ahead and he did certain things that he was not supposed to, and on the other hand, Yossi and Bela paid for certain improvements that they wanted, and he didn't do it. So they have a problem. No, Bill Sasheb.
Okay.
They'll live with it. Okay.
Great.
It goes to show you that we may be studying Marcus, but boy, we get into a miscellany.
Well, look, didn't the Chachamim also do this?
Yes, absolutely.
Didn't they also digress on things
yes.
that they felt were important?
Yes. All right. Now, here we have another statement which brings us again. A little afield, okay? The Yomar Rav Yehuda Omar Rav, right? Same character, right? And what did he quote now in the name of Rav? He says, Shloshes Lugin Mayim.
Right.
Three lugs of water, Shanapal Asoichan, into which there has fallen Kotov Shalyain, a tiny bit, tiny amount of wine, Umarehan, and the appearance now of these three Lugin, right? Is Kamare Yain, it looks now like wine.
Right.
And then what happened? Noftul the mikveh, and then they fell into a mikveh. So he says, Lo pisolu. They did not make the mikveh puzzle. All right. I'm going to tell you right now, let's take a look at the art school Siddur. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this particular thing, but we have more over there, so get a look, okay? We'll look at the screen of ours. Down below over there, we have more copies. Okay. All right, I'll tell you where to turn right now. Let's see whether they have smokers. And you know smokers. Okay.
What are you looking for?
The death and bereavement section.
Oh.
Okay, let's turn to page 802, approximately. Not on 802, then it's in someplace else. It's a custom that when you have a yurt site, so you recite, right, you study Mishnah in memory of the person who passed away, okay? Well, naturally, it could be any Mishnah that you study, any chapter, whatever you want to do, right? And some people have the habit, for example, of learning Mishnah that begins with the first letter of every name of the name. For example, let's say that the name is Abraham, so you learn a chapter that begins with an Aleph, another with a Beis, another with a Resh, and so on and so forth. Okay, but okay,
802,
I said. Okay, all right, we take a look over there and we see that the chapter that is suggested for study in memory of the deceased comes from the Gemara Mikvois, right, which of course by its name you know that it's going to deal with Mikvah, okay? And the first Mishnah over there deals with the problem of Yesh Malis HaMikvah LePeislin, Peislin LeMalin, LeMalin LePeislin. There are three different categories of liquids, okay? In the one case, the liquid may fall into a mikveh which is not quite complete yet, okay? It's missing three more lugin in order to reach the 40 saw, which is the minimum requirement for a mikveh, okay? So they may raise it. If the liquid of this type falls in, it will raise it to the, you know, if let's say three lugan fall into it, or it does not be three lugan, it could be even only one lugan, something falls in. But it raises it to the prescribed level, right? And it's not going to render the mikveh invalid. Okay. Then there are other liquids that if you throw them into the mikveh, they're going to invalidate the entire mikveh. No good. And then a third category would be lo ma'alin ve lo postin, liquids that neither add nor detract, you know, from the mikveh, and to the extent that it's not going to make it either possible, right, or make it consider it as a completion of the mikveh either, you know, that it gives you the minimum cost. So that's one of the requirements. Okay, requirements are that a mikveh has to have body saw of water, which is natural water. By natural water, it could be, right, let's say, spring water, but not coming through pipes. You understand?
Right.
Or it could be rainwater, which is gathered and eventually forms, you know, enough. Or it could be, let's say, snow, which can melt, and then, you know, once it becomes liquefied, so this is also considered natural water. Okay. Now, among those substances which may or may not be valid, okay, to take a bucket of water and put it into the mikveh in order to enable it to reach the prescribed amount, this will invalidate the mikveh. It will invalidate it. Because if the mikveh did not have the required amount, come on in.
Is the water all right?
I hope so. Come and take a plunge. Okay. A mikveh to be kosher has to have, as we said, at least 40 saw, right, of natural water. Okay. It cannot be what we call mayim she'uvin. Mayim she'uvin means literally water that has been drawn and then thrown in, you know, with a bucket, okay? Or with plumbing either. I mean, you can't simply open up a faucet and let it come in into the mikveh and, you know, and say that this is a kosher mikveh. That's also not so. Mikveh has to be constructed so that, first of all, you have at least the 40 saw of natural water. And secondly, that even if you empty out the mikveh, but there is another mikveh which contains, a boris we say, which contains the prescribed amount, and that can be joined to the other one. This is what we call hashaka. It can be joined with the other. So that at all times the minimum is always there, and therefore in the part of the mikveh in which a person immerses himself, like let's say in the mikveh in Longmeadow, right? So even though, you know, we change the water and so on, but that water is not considered shu'uvin because you have the other water which is connected to it, which is kosher, which is a kosher mikveh. Understand? All right.
But that water is coming through pipes, though.
Huh?
That water is coming through
that
pipes.
That was right. But what if you have, for example, a hole in the ground, right? And rainwater, enough rainwater, or snow fell in and so on, made a mikveh, then in that case you wouldn't need the connection, you know, between one and another. But right, of course, it will be a permanent body of water over there. But if it dries out, then you have to wait for the next time, you know, that there's going to be a rainfall or something. You cannot take a bucket and bring it in, you know, bring in water and add to it, because that would invalidate everything, okay? It means then they have to start right from the very beginning again, okay? So, water, as we say, is mayim she'uvin, okay? If it is water, if it looks like water, and it has been brought, as I said, with a bucket, or it has been brought simply through the faucet, then that in itself cannot be used in order to make the mikveh kosher if the mikveh to begin with did not have the minimum amount. If a mikveh has the minimum amount, then it is permitted to add water to it, and then you can take out some water, because the basic amount remains over there. As long as it always remains, you know, at 40 saw, at least the minimum amount, then you're permitted to do that. That you can do. Okay? Alright. Now, what kind of liquids can be added and they're not going to paisel the mikvah. This is what the Mishnah wants to know. Okay? So on the next page, all right, you see on the top over there, it says, Kesa Malan Paisel. Now we'll do it in English. How do they complete not invalidated? So it says, if a mikvah contains 40 saw less one, all right? There's one saw that's missing. And a saw, one of these substances, fall into weird, then it completes the mikvah, and so it completes it and doesn't invalidate it. Okay. Now, what kind of substances are we talking about it? So, the first one that tells you is what's no good, what will invalidate it, namely water, right? Whether contaminated, not contaminated, water in which you've soaked fruits or cooked fruits and vegetables and things like that, and so on and so forth. Okay. So, this not only will it invalidate a mikveh if the mikveh contains less than the minimum amount, but also, you know, it certainly won't add anything to it. However, then it says, but other liquids such as fruit juice, right? Fish oil, mark wine, which is fermented, sometimes they complete and sometimes not. Okay, so if some of these things come in, all right, and then the next question they asked over there, take a look in the Mishnah 3 over there. If you rinse an olive basket or grape baskets in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what has it done? It's changed the color of the water, right? But nevertheless, there's nothing over there on, you know, of course we're taking an empty basket, let's say, which only it has enough of a residue in order to change the color, but it doesn't contain anything else. Okay. However, how about dye water? In other words, made seva, which is what they're going to talk about over here. Then in that case, it's going to invalidate, right? It will invalidate it if there are three logan in it, but it doesn't invalidate it by change of color. Now, this is what the issue is going to be over here, as we're going to see right now. So we have a couple of minutes here before minimum time.
Yeah,
let's get back to our text right now. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
How'd you give me the place?
Yeah. So.
Can we make quickly?
Yeah.
What Rav Yehuda is saying in the name of Rav is that, right, if that three logan of mayim, right, water, they fall, and even, you know, and just even a tiny amount of wine came, but it changed the color, right, and they fell into the mikveh, then they're not going to invalidate the mikveh. Why won't they invalidate the mikveh? Because now, on the basis of the color is that of not water, but the color of
wine.
Okay, so it's considered as if everything will wine in this particular case. All right. So that's the first point. Okay. Well, Rav Kahn is not happy with that, just as he's objected to all the other statements, so he's objecting over here too. So, Matzkev lo Rav Kahn, Rav Kahn objects, and he says, V'chima bein zeh lemeit seva, what difference is it between this and between colored water? Now, I don't like the colored water. I prefer really to read it as made saba. Saba in Hebrew is a dyer, because to me that makes better sense.
Dye water.
Right. In other words, this is water caused, you know, by the dyer, and, you know, and this is water which is mixed in with dye. Okay. So, and what did we learn? We learned in this Mishnah that we just learned, right? The Tanan, we learned in the Mishnah that says that Rabbi Yossi Omer, right, made...